campamentos de verano para niños. No abandones tu inglés.
Las plazas vuelan, así que llama ya al 91-133-5832. 91-133-5832.
¿Quieres tener clases 100% orales compatible con tu jornada laboral? Llámanos al 911-335833, 911-335833 y apúntate a los cursos de inglés trimestrales. 3 meses y notarás la diferencia.
This is Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host. My name is Guy Williams. On this program, I'm going to be talking about the bad days for the Union, for the North, for the United States of America during the time of the Civil War, when nothing went right. Everybody began to suffer, and Lincoln lost all his popularity, not just at home, but abroad as well. Remember that they began by losing, and they kept losing. The balance of victories was with the Confederacy, and you have to remember that the Confederacy did not need to win the war. They just needed to maintain the status quo, while the North was obliged to win the battles and then occupy a part of the country, you know, that was very different, that nobody really understood. And it was going to be very difficult to achieve. It was going to be done at great cost. But let's talk about the beginning. In the international front, the United States put its foot in it. A Union warship stopped a British steamship called Trent, and there were diplomats, Confederate diplomats, on that ship that were going to England, France, and Spain, trying to convince the European capitals to recognize the South. The diplomats in question, John Slidell and James Mason, were taken off the Trent, and you can imagine the British were furious. It's not something anybody does. And this is a perfect casus belli. If the British had wanted to go to war then, they could have. Lincoln was most embarrassed by what had happened. I mean, it was a very stupid, amateurish thing to do. And because London was the financial capital of the world, you can imagine the contractions, the convulsions in New York. Banks suspended payments. They said they would no longer offer gold or silver. And from that moment on, nobody wanted to buy war bonds, right? Bonos del Estado. The United States is going to have to print money to finance the war, right? All of this demand. It's curious. You know, people who talk about laissez-faire, people who talk about Adam Smith, people who talk about the invisible hand, people who talk about leaving the markets alone, and that less government, the government that governs least governs best, that markets are wiser than any individual. Well, what these people don't realize, perhaps, is that historically, finance, financial instruments, and knowledge about the economy has always been the result of governments borrowing very heavily and almost always for military purposes, right, in order to finance wars. And yes, the United States is going to come out of the Civil War completely changed. In order to finance the war, they will be printing money so quickly that they don't even have time to print anything on the back, right? El dorso del billete, the back of the bill. Remember that in the United States we say bill, a dollar bill, and in British English it's a note, a pound note. But these bills had nothing on the back except a solid green color. That's how cheap they were. And also how easy to falsificar, how easy to counterfeit. Because the backs were green, the dollars were then called greenbacks. And greenback became synonymous with dollar, even today. You can say, I want to be paid in greenbacks. But yes, the head of the Treasury of Secretary, Secretary to the Treasury, Salmon Chase, he said that he simply had no money. And that's when the new general, the head of the army, McClellan, got typhoid. And, you know, just when it looks like things can't get worse, the only good news at this time is Ulysses S. Grant, a general out in the West. Now, Grant had served in the army. He was in Mexico, if I remember. He resigned. He had gone into business. He had failed, gone bankrupt again and again, and now he was back in the army. He was sent out west, where his job was rivers. All of the West is about rivers. Remember that the Confederacy in general, everything on the other side of the Appalachians is river. Those rivers point like little arrows, flechas, no, to the heart of the South. All of those rivers flow from north to south. And Grant moved quickly to capture a couple of those rivers, the Cumberland River, the Tennessee River, making Nashville the first Confederate state capital. Nashville, Tennessee, the first Confederate state capital to fall. The Confederates had been attacking Kentucky. Now, because of Grant's presence on the Cumberland River, Kentucky was safe. Tennessee was now in Union hands. And they say that precisely because Grant had experience with failure, it made him more willing to take risks. He had very little to lose. In the end, Grant is going to become general of all the armies. In the end, the Union wins because of Grant. The Union wins because finally Lincoln has a general capable of doing something. But as I say, initially things simply go from bad to worse year after year. But then materially, the South doesn't have a lot, and there are blockades now, so that the South sooner or later is going to begin to suffer in a big way from lack of access to the wider world, lack of supplies. And as I say, 22 million people in the North, with more arriving every day, the North being a very attractive destination for immigrants. And there, as soon as the ship arrives, there are recruiters from the army trying to get these people to fight for their new country. So yes, 22 million in the North and 9 million in the South, of which 3.5 million are slaves. So yeah, demographically, the South has everything to lose. But the South goes from victory to victory. And yet, these are Pyrrhic victories. My listeners will be familiar with Pyrrhus, the great leader, the king of Epirus, on the western side of what is today Greece, right, on the near the Adriatic Sea, just across the sea from the boot of Italy. And this is at a time when there are Greek colonies all through southern Italy. And yes, some of them in Sicily, for example, have fallen victim to the Carthaginians. But others are feeling more and more pressure from the Romans, Roman hegemony. And so one colony in particular, Tarentum, calls Epirus and asks him to defend them. And he fights. He is victorious, but the price is so high. I mean, the logistics are bad. His supply lines are thin. And he says, if I win one more victory like this, I will lose the war. And this is the paradox of Pyrrhus, the fact that you can be victorious, but that victory comes at a price you cannot afford to pay. And this is why we call, we refer to all of this as a Pyrrhic victory. And yes, the South was enjoying multiple Pyrrhic victories at this point. Victories that were unsustainable. Meanwhile, good news for the North, New Orleans was taken by a man named David Farragut, who was, because of this, promoted to admiral, making him the United States' first admiral. And Farragut was a man nobody had believed in, because Farragut was from Virginia. Because of this, his loyalties were questioned. Nobody was that willing to trust him. But, well, after New Orleans, the Union position was very comfortable. The transportation there is all fluvial. You have to go by river. The roads, the railroads, they're no good. You travel. Travel means travel by river. All of the rivers go from north to south, and it all goes past New Orleans. Whoever controls New Orleans controls the heart of the United States. But just upriver, at a place called Vicksburg, the Confederacy had built an impregnable, impregnable fortress. Vicksburg called the Gibraltar of the Confederacy. And that was going to be very, very difficult. And take extensive operations and quite a lot of time. But yes, the general in charge of that will be Ulysses S. Grant. Meanwhile, the other theater of the war, right on the other side of the Appalachian Mountains, to the east, going down from those hills to the coast, all of those rivers run west to east, all of them in parallel, and all of them forming natural lines of defense, making it very difficult for armies to cross. Now, I said on an earlier program that when Virginia decided to join the Confederacy, as a reward, it got the capital. The capital of the Confederacy, of the CSA, Confederate States of America, was now Richmond in Virginia. And Richmond was not that far from Washington, D.C., so that many, many of the battles in this war are going to be located between D.C. and Richmond. But the commander of the Union Army, of the Potomac Army, McClellan, called, well, compared to Napoleon, as the young Napoleon, he has an idea of overcoming this defense by maritime transport. He's going to take 100,000 men and the equipment necessary, supplies, animals, an absolute masterpiece of logistics. He's going to take them all by sea south of Richmond and attack the city. He believes that if he can eliminate Richmond, the war will be over. But then there's something that people begin to understand about his psychology almost immediately, especially the enemy. The enemy knows what his failings are. McClellan is overly cautious. It is very easy to convince McClellan that there are more enemy troops than there actually are. One of the big tricks of the South was to take tree trunks and paint them black so that they looked like cannon. If you saw them from a distance, you would think that the enemy had lots and lots of cannon at their disposal. But of course, they were tree trunks. And of course, with the wry sense of humor, right, guasa, characterizing the soldiers at that time, they called them Quaker cannon, right? De los Quakeros, because Quakers are pacifists. And so, yeah, Quaker cannon, the oldest trick in the book. And so, yeah, McClellan, bad weather. There's nothing, any pretext not to fight. So, and then McClellan and Abraham Lincoln arguing back and forth like an old married couple, using old arguments, using tired arguments. They're sick of each other, but it's too late to get a divorce. So, yes, McClellan missed his window of opportunity. If he had moved quickly, he would have taken Richmond easily, and in the end, he did not. Meanwhile, you had Robert E. Lee on the other side. Lee and his right-hand man, Stonewall Jackson, they just turned everything around. Lee, very gifted as a soldier, and the commander, Winfield Scott, right, at the beginning of the war, wanted Lee to command the Union Army. He knew that Lee, even though Lee was Virginian, Scott was Virginian. I just mentioned David Farragut, America's first admiral, the man who took New Orleans. He was also Virginian. But Lee decided he did not want command of the Union armies. He said, I must side either with or against my section. I cannot raise my hand against my birthplace, my home, my children. And yeah, three of his children fighting for the South, he joined them. He joined the Confederate Army. Initially, he was working with the president of the South, with Jefferson Davis. And Lee used Stonewall Jackson in this case. Stonewall Jackson, with 17,000 men, was able to move around so quickly that his men earned a new name. They called them the Foot Cavalry. Right. Normally you have infantry on foot or cavalry on horseback. But if you call these people the foot cavalry, you're saying that they can move as fast as if they were on horseback. They marched in the course of a month about 500 kilometers, winning four battles against three Union armies. And in these, they were frequently outnumbered. And in these, they were able to, as I say, fool the enemy. One of the most famous tricks They were marching on the side of the hill, so the enemies could see them marching on the side of the hill. And the soldiers kept coming and coming. Enormous numbers of soldiers coming around that hill. But what the enemy did not see is that as soon as the troops got out of sight, they went back over the hill, ran as quickly as they could, and began to march a second time around the hill. So that these were actually the same troops going around the hill again and again and again. But the enemy was completely convinced that they were outnumbered, that Jackson was in command of three times as many troops as he actually had. The commander-in-chief of the Southern forces was wounded, put out of action, and Robert E. Lee took over. As I say, he was the best. He was the best product of West Point, of the best military training. Robert E. Lee had served with distinction in Mexico, and he was ready to take risks. He had charisma, a real, genuine charisma. His men were devoted to him. They would do anything for him. And they knew he was competent, right? They knew that he was by far the best chance of them winning the war. Moreover, Lee could read the mind of his opponent. And with all the Union generals he was fighting, maybe because he knew these people personally before the war, but he knew how they thought. He knew what they were planning. He seemed to know what they were going to do before they did. And this was not the result of espionage. It was the result of intuition. So you can imagine, from euphoria at the beginning of the war, the morale in the Union collapsed to complete despair. With this and with so many successful battles, Lee decided to bring it home to the enemy, to show the enemy that they were not invulnerable, that they could be attacked as well. And he wanted to take the army into Maryland. There was a second advantage in that it was harvest time by then. This was in late August, early September. And so La Cosecha, by keeping the enemy in Maryland, by keeping the battles in Maryland and out of Virginia, they could bring in a successful harvest. So they found a place to ford. A ford, como badear, look for a place in a river that you can cross. Not really an important word in Spanish. Spain doesn't have that many rivers that traditionally needed to be forded. But anywhere that you can ford a river, anywhere that you can cross a river, where the river is not too deep, that is going to, that's going to be famous. You're going to have a concentration of roads going there, a concentration of people. And so in England, typically names like Bedford and Bradford, and of course one of my favorites, Vado de los Bueyes, Oxford. And you know that these places have been used from prehistoric times. In the German language, the same thing as Furt, and so you have a place like Frankfurt, El Vado de los Francos. But, yes, in a Mediterranean world, you really don't talk that much about fords. And their prime importance in Northern Europe, and in this case, in the United States. The Potomac River, And remember that Washington, D.C. is on the Potomac. So theoretically, whoever controls the Potomac controls Washington. Well, you find a place to ford that river. In this case, 60 kilometers upriver from D.C. You can imagine, if Maryland falls to the Confederacy, then D.C. will have to be abandoned. I mean, there's too much proximity. Maryland flanks D.C. Can you imagine if D.C. is captured? At least this was part of the thinking then. Meanwhile, at the very least, you have midterm elections, right? Many senators and congressmen facing re-election. And what is this going to do to control of the Senate and control of the House of Representatives if you have Lee in Maryland? Okay, I have to take a break. I'll be back in just a minute.
Con la última pregunta del examen, vaya, parece que le ha caído el pass perfect. Lorena lleva toda la temporada entrenando el pass perfect, pero nunca ha sido su punto fuerte. ¡Wow! Eso es Lorena. Vamos, vamos, fill the gap, Lorena. ¡Wow! Increíble, has acertado todas. ¡Qué barbaridad! Lorena Martínez, señoras y señores, qué crack, el examen es de 10.
Consigue que tus hijos sean unos auténticos cracks del inglés con los cursos del Club Junior. No solo mejorarán sus notas, sino que hablarán inglés de verdad y serán capaces de comunicarse. Y por si eso fuera poco, lo pasan genial en clase. Club Junior son las clases para niños de 4 a 17 años en grupos muy reducidos y 100% método Vaughan. Infórmate ya en el 911-335-832, 911-335-832 o en grupovaughan.com.
Bonjour à tous. Aujourd'hui, je vous propose de nous interroger.
¿Sabías que en Vaughan no solo enseñamos inglés? Ya está a la venta el nuevo libro Écoute, con el que mejorarás tu comprensión auditiva en francés, tengas el nivel que tengas. A lo largo de 45 capítulos que irán aumentando en dificultad, expondrás tu oído al francés hablado en diferentes acentos y registros. Las grabaciones y podcasts, en su mayoría de emisoras de radio y de televisión, se trabajan en el libro a través de preguntas de comprensión y ejercicios al más estilo Vaughan, para que realmente seas capaz de superar la difícil barrera de entender a los nativos. ¿Qu'est-ce que tu attends? ¿A qué esperas? Consigue Écoute por solo 16,95 en Vaughan Tienda o en tu librería favorita.
Hoy en día muchos piensan que con las nuevas tecnologías ya no va a hacer falta encargar traducciones profesionales. Pues yo creo que no. Yo sigo viendo barbaridades por ahí cuando se intenta traducir con máquinas. Encontré hace poco que el Centro Botín, es decir, de la Fundación Botín, creo, es traducida como Loot Center, o sea, centro de saqueo. ¿Botín? ¿Saqueo? Bueno, pero yo creo que no. El casco antiguo de una famosa ciudad española se traducía como Historic Helmet. ¿Casco? También se puede decir yelmo histórico, como dice la máquina. Helmet, yelmo, casco, ¿qué más da? Hasta en los restaurantes de más prestigio se pueden encontrar joyas gracias a la tecnología traductora. Peppers with beautiful, o sea, pimientos con bonito. Muy hermosos serán esos pimientos, digo yo. Habitas con jamón. Fácil para la tecnología. You live with ham. O sea, tú habitas, yo habito. Todos, por lo visto, habitamos con jamón. Pues, es verdad, supongo. ¿Quién querrá vivir sin jamón? Fino tío Pepe. Thin Uncle Joseph. Bueno, sí le noto un poco más delgado al tío últimamente. Y ya lo más legendario, rape a la marinera. Rape sailor style. O sea, violación al estilo marinero. Bueno, no creo yo. Estos son ejemplos curiosos, divertidos, pero miles de escritos importantes salen de España con errores importantes. La palabra escrita lleva más la imagen de una persona o de una empresa que la palabra hablada. No se la juegue cuando se trate de traducir algo importante. Confíe en los profesionales. Confíe en Vaughan. Vaughan Translations. Al entrar en el mercado laboral, lo único que cuenta es ser más atractivo que otros candidatos, gozar de mayor estimación. Y el aspecto que más impacta a una empresa cuando mira un candidato joven es su nivel de inglés. Si es muy alto, es contratado. Si no lo es, pues no. Aunque sea el número uno en su promoción, nuestro MIP, nuestro Máster en Inglés Profesional, resuelve este tema para el candidato.
Máster en Inglés Profesional de Vaughan. Infórmese en el 911-335-833. 911-335-833.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Western Civilization, from Mesopotamia to Silicon Valley. I'm your host. My name is Guy Williams, and on the first part of the program, I was talking about the strategy of Robert E. Lee at a time when everything seems to be going right for the South. Lee has decided to take the war home to the Union. He's decided to attack the Union in its home ground. He has invaded Maryland. At the very least, this is going to influence the midterm elections. A significant number of senators and congressmen facing re-election, and an increasing number of members of the Democratic Party vocally anti-war. In fact, there are members of the Democratic Party that are refusing to cooperate with a war. And if Lincoln loses any more popularity, these voices could prevail. Or better still, you could get France or Britain to recognize the South. And all of these considerations weighed heavily on Lincoln. This is when he decided to drop the bomb, the Emancipation Proclamation. He was going to declare that slaves in enemy states are free. Slaves in the slave-owning states that are part of the Union are not included, because there's a great risk that they would join the enemy. But Lincoln, I spoke about Lincoln on an earlier program, saying that he was always opposed, very highly morally opposed to slavery. He hated the idea of slavery and wanted to do anything to abolish it, but didn't believe until that moment that the time was ready. Now, we had to consider the possibility that this is a total war requiring the mobilization of every resource and the destruction of every enemy resource. It is a time to take the mask off, because at least initially people were speaking as if the war were about states' rights. Whether any state could voluntarily leave the Union. There had been attempts to leave in 1821, 1828, crises that had been overcome, but people knew, even as the rhetoric was going on, that, you know, Lincoln saying, "A house divided against itself shall not stand." The South, at least initially, in their rebellion, stating unequivocally that it's all about slavery. the fact that slavery is benign, slavery is morally right. Remember that biblically the argument in favor of slavery is stronger than the argument against slavery. So, for example, San Pablo, right, Paul of Tarsus, saying that one of the very worst kinds of people in the world is the kind of person who would steal a slave. And this is precisely what Lincoln intends to do with the Emancipation Proclamation. Now, this is going to go very well in England. You have to remember that the British Empire had abolished slavery and was very proud of having abolished slavery. Moreover, throughout Britain, there was a very, very strong abolitionist feeling, the idea that slavery is morally repugnant and that decent people everywhere are obliged to oppose it. So all of this was decided that emancipation is a military necessity. Emancipation is essential to the preservation of the Union. The only thing necessary would be a military victory. That victory came. It was a victory over Lee in Maryland at a place called Antietam. Although all of these great battles of the Civil War are called by one name in the North and by another name in the South. In the South, it was known as Sharpsburg. So Confederates, speaking of this battle, call it Sharpsburg. But the North and the history books refer to it as Antietam. And on January 1st, 1863, as of January 1st, slaves in all states still in rebellion shall be thenceforward, right, desde entonces en adelante, thenceforward, and forever free. And I'm going to use a little, a small digression. Now, these are words that you should know. These are words that you will never need. These are words that you do not need to know. But these are words that you should know. You know the word here. Well, there's an old word that means to hear in this way, coming toward here. And that word is hither. H-I-T-H-E-R. Today we would say come here, but in the past, or poetically, you would say come hither. And in standard English, you might say, up until now, right? Hasta ahora, up until now. But an alternative way to say that is hitherto. So, for example, hitherto you thought English was easy, didn't you? So you have hither, you have here, and then you have from here, or away from here, and that would be hence. Hither, here, and hence. So yes, in Shakespeare, or the translation of the Bible, or Game of Thrones, you would have somebody say, go hence, go from here, go away from here. Or henceforward, meaning from now on. And so, hence, by the way, also used in logical argument, in cause and effect. So that, the normal way to indicate cause and effect is so. I was hungry, so I had something to eat. The mistake that Spanish people make is to translate entonces. The entonces in the Spanish language has this causal understanding. You know, it was because of that reason. That is why I did what I did. Terminé y entonces me marché.
But if you try to translate that with then in English, then simply means y después. So you can imagine the mistake. Se me acabó el dinero y después fui al banco. Right? There's no causality there. You simply list a sequence of events. You don't connect them. What you really want is not then, obviously. It's so. I ran out of money, so I went to the bank. And you can substitute that, especially in written English, for cultismos, right? Por tanto, therefore, or thus, or the one I just mentioned, hence. And hence is, it's very good because in Spanish you have something very similar. De ahí, right? Hubo una subida repentina de precios y de ahí un pánico entre inversores, right? A sudden rise in prices and hence panic among investors. So yes, words that you don't have to know, but are nice to know. Hither and hence. And of course, where you have a here, you have a there. And where you have a hither, you have a thither, meaning to there. And thence, from there. And you have the word that I just used from the Emancipation Proclamation, thence forward. De ahí en adelante. The slaves in all states still in rebellion shall be then, thenceforward, and forever free. And yes, it was a great victory, the victory of Antietam, and very popular, surprisingly popular, the Emancipation Proclamation, although, some people were opposed, especially the Northern Democrats, the anti-war group, calling it wicked and unholy, right? Como demonico, diabolico. But to Lincoln, Antietam was not a victory because McClellan could have done so much better. Someone had discovered the orders, the secret orders. McClellan knew in advance what Lee was going to do. And he dithered, vaciló. He was indecisive. And he didn't follow up the victory. He could have destroyed Lee in Maryland, and he did not. Lincoln sent all kinds of letters to McClellan, blaming him. And finally, he was fired. Ambrose Burnside was put in charge of the army. And as soon as he was in charge of the army, led to one of the most horrible defeats that the Union ever suffered. The Battle of Fredericksburg. Lincoln, when he heard the news of the defeat, he said, "If there is a worse place than hell, I am in it." And of course, it didn't help that his personal life was going from bad to worse. His wife suffering from almost constant depression, you know, and they were from Kentucky. Kentucky decided to stay with the North, but many people in Kentucky had their heart in the South. And one of the things that cheered Mary Todd Lincoln up, right, the president's wife, was to invite relatives to come stay with her at the White House. So she was frequently entertaining family there. And her cousins were actively engaging in espionage for the Confederacy, for the Southern cause. They were discovered looking at secret papers. They were discovered trying to read classified material.
But of course, and because she was so depressed, so inclined to melancholy, and the president himself was deep in despair, it was a very delicate situation. Yes, meanwhile, the Confederates were strengthening their position in Vicksburg, so they had command of the middle of the Mississippi River. They had lost the mouth. They had lost New Orleans. And they obviously never had control of the North. But if the Union could take Vicksburg, okay, it was going to be a cooperative effort between General Ulysses S. Grant and General William Tecumseh Sherman, a Sherman sailing down the Mississippi to attack Vicksburg, and Grant by land. The attempt didn't work. It was going to take more than that. The news was very bad, very depressing, and the United States, in the winter of 1862 to 1863, just declined into a terrible state of depression. Oh, depression, civil disobedience, tension, and defeatism, right? Derrotismo, defeatism. The Chicago Tribune, which was pro-war, pro-Union, pro-Lincoln, pro-Republican, they just gave up. They said, an armistice is bound, guaranteed, right? Determined. An armistice is bound to come during the year 63. The Rebs, meaning the Rebs can't be conquered by the present machinery. General Ambrose Burnside, he was the victim of bad weather as well. There was a time he was marching his men, the weather changed. It started to rain. It rained so hard that his entire army was stuck in the mud and immobilized. And Burnside was replaced by Joseph Hooker, called Fighting Joe, a man who was not afraid to take chances. But the future hero of the army at this point, General Grant. And yes, at this time, General Grant, working in Vicksburg, the Gibraltar of the West, the impregnable fortress. Mordor from the Lord of the Rings, with tropical disease. I mean, it was very bad, situation, unhealthy for his troops. And it looked like inactivity, right? People said about Grant that he was alcoholic. Now, subsequently, biographers have said that, you know, this was not true. But at that time, it was something everybody believed. And Lincoln was pressured to fire Grant. He said, what I want, Lincoln, what I want is generals who will fight battles and win victories. Grant has done this, and I propose to stand by him. Tell me what kind of whiskey he drinks, and I will send a case to all of my other generals. And Lincoln suffered the, well, unpopularity of his generals. There was a generalized lack of respect. People surrounding the president did not treat him with respect. Meanwhile, there was a kind of quinta columna, right? I talked about that earlier. The term fifth column comes from the Spanish Civil War, when most people say it was Emilio Mola, said to an interviewer that he planned to attack Madrid with four columns, but there was already a fifth column waiting in Madrid to help them. And it is quite true. Madrid was filled with saboteurs. There were people driving around in cars and shooting at random. And many, many people giving accurate information to the nacionales. But just the idea of this happening raised the level of paranoia in Madrid, so that neighbors were denouncing each other as quinta columnistas. And any time anything went wrong, you could blame it on a quinta columnista, fifth columnists. The fifth column, as the American journalists put that into standard English vocabulary. It was used in the United States immediately. And as far as I know, it's used in most languages. But as I say, it comes from Spanish. The term comes from Spanish. It's like the word liberal or the word macho. It begins in Spanish and is understood in every language. Now, the these people in the United States, initially called peace Democrats, right? They were in the opposition party. They were pacifists. And the Republicans began to call them copperheads, cabezas de cobre. Now, the copperhead is a viper. It is poisonous. It is dangerous. Many people have been killed by copperheads. Nobody wants to come into contact with a copperhead, right? The ponzoña, the venom that they exude is particularly mortal or lethal. Now, these people liked the name, and so they took it on themselves to call themselves copperheads. And what they did was to take pennies and cut a little silhouette out of the penny. There was a face on the penny. And so you cut out the face from the rest of the penny. Pennies are made of copper, and you use that as your copper head. And you can use that as a pin. But yes, it will indicate your political affiliation. Now, the copperheads were in control of the legislatures of Indiana and Illinois. And those two states immediately called for armistice and negotiation. They are the ones who decided that the Emancipation Proclamation was wicked, malvado. It was inhuman. It was unholy, diabolico. And they said that they were going to withdraw their troops, all the troops from Illinois, all the troops from Indiana, from the war. But again, that was the legislature. The governors of both these states were Republican. But you can imagine the jurisdictional conflict. There was one particular peace Democrat, a man named Vallandigham, from Ohio, and he said, I see more of barbarism and sin, pecado, 1,000 times more in the continuance of this war and the enslavement of the white race by debt and taxes than in the continuation of slavery. In other words, with this effort to help the black race, what Lincoln is going to actually do is reduce the white race to enslavement. Now, this is a technique a little like victimization, where you try to make people think that the aggressor is the victim. This is an attempt to make people think that instead of liberation, the war is now about enslaving the white race. He wanted to be governor of Ohio, and he asked widely, you know, what has the war accomplished so far? Well, let the dead at Fredericksburg and Vicksburg answer that question. And his rhetoric was enormously effective. There was a wave of desertion and serious non-cooperation in places where Copperheads had control, in this case, Ohio, but also Illinois and Indiana. And so, Vallandigham was arrested. The local military commander arrested him and turned him over to a military court. The military court convicted him of treason, and people everywhere were horrified. Does this mean now that military courts can try civilians, can try politicians? Are we under martial law? Why was this not done in a civil court? And then Lincoln, seeing where this was going, sent the man to the Confederacy. But all right, I seem to have run out of time. Thank you for listening, and please listen to my next program.
Semana en un lugar apartado.
Nativos angloparlantes de todas partes del mundo, uno por cada estudiante.
Terminantemente prohibido hablar en español.
Actividades organizadas y conversaciones en inglés a todas horas. No exageramos.
Aquí o hablas inglés o hablas inglés.
Y da igual las veces que te lo contemos.
Hasta que no lo vivas no sabrás que Vaughan Town te va a quitar el miedo al inglés para siempre.
Lo que pasa en Vaughan Town no se puede contar.
Tienes que vivirlo.
Ven a Vaughan Town.
Más información, grupovaughan.com.
En los Urban Camps tenemos un montón de aventuras y temáticas disponibles y todo sin que los